KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Oh, Redwood City, California.
Hayward?
Near Richmond, Richmond District, kind of.
I'm from Concord.
Martinez.
Hercules.
I'm from Marina, California.
SF State, wherever that is.
Coming up, we have a show that may make your mouth water.
Ghirardelli and Guittard have obviously been around for a really long time, but more recently, Cho and then Scharfenberger kicked off the new American chocolate movement.
The Bay Area's long history of chocolate connoisseurs. Then we'll meet local artisans who are changing the way we consume it.
I wanted to put chocolate back in the limelight as this food of the gods and put it back in this place of reverence and respect that it had been in for thousands and thousands of years throughout its history in the Americas.
It's Chocolate O'Clock on Cross Currents. Stay with us. On Market Street, just at the Embarcadero, there's this newsstand that doubles as a treasure trove of chocolate.
Red coconut curry. Dark chocolate, crunchy coconut flakes, and a hint of heat. If I open up the backside,
Fog City News sells over 200 different chocolate bars, and there's some interesting ones too, with ingredients like lemongrass oil and smoked chilies.
Lime essential oil and dried chilies. And if I had you taste this bar with your eyes closed.
Owner Adam Smith is a fine chocolate cheerleader.
I tell new employees when I hire them, you're going to chocolate university. You think that you're going.
And Adam is defending a thesis on local chocolate.
The mecca of chocolate is the Bay Area in the United States.
And as KALW's Asal Ehsanipour found out, the Bay has always been a center for innovation in chocolate.
Earlier this month, thousands of people gathered under the glittering, iconic Ghirardelli chocolate sign for the company's 23rd annual chocolate festival. People like Barbara Durst-Taylor, who's here all the way from Riverside.
I am a chocoholic and I love to make chocolate desserts, and everybody, my friends, expect me to make chocolate desserts.
Ghirardelli's story unfolded during the Gold Rush with one of San Francisco's first Italian immigrants. Soon after Domingo Ghirardelli arrived, he realized his fortune was not in bars of gold, but chocolate. He sold chocolate candy and other goods to gold miners. Well over a century later, Ghirardelli is the oldest continuously operating chocolate manufacturer in the U.S., older than even Hershey.
Ghirardelli of San Francisco. We craft the most indulgent chocolate.
Ghirardelli has always branded itself as a bastion of San Franciscan chocolate.
We pour our hearts into every square.
But there is another chocolate company with an almost identical origin story. During the Gold Rush, Etienne Guittard, who learned to make chocolate at his uncle's factory in France, originally traded chocolate for mining supplies. But he returned to France, brought back his own equipment, and founded Guittard Chocolate Company.
We are seeing 10-pound bars being deposited in a machine that's really pretty darn old, but it works really great.
President and CEO Gary Guittard shows me the complex process of making chocolate.
This is where it all starts.
This is where it all starts.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, we get the beans from a warehouse over in across the bay.
It starts with burlap bags that stack to the ceiling, full of fermented cocoa beans.
Single roasting of each origin.
Gary explains that here on site, they're then cleaned, destoned, winnowed, roasted, and ground.
But after we do the pre-grinding, and it's basically like grinding peanuts. When you grind peanuts, you get peanut butter. And when you grind the nibs, you get unsweetened chocolate.
We dart puddles of that unsweetened chocolate, weave through heavy machinery, and duck under pipes throughout the tour. The space is stuffy until we reach a cool area with finished chocolate chips, the tiniest I've ever seen.
10,000 chips to a pound, so these are little teeny tiny guys.
For years, Guittard and Ghirardelli had factories just blocks away from each other, their smells blending and swirling through the city.
You smelled all of that stuff in downtown San Francisco. You could walk down Montgomery Street and smell coffee or smell chocolate. So that's gone.
Because both companies moved production to the suburbs. Today, Ghirardelli is owned by the Swiss mass chocolate maker Lindt, but Guittard remains family-owned and operated, the oldest of its kind in the country. They supply chocolatiers like Charles Chocolate and Ricchiuti.
That is going to seize.
Even seize candy. Guittard and Ghirardelli started at the same time in the same place because San Francisco could import cacao along Pacific trade routes. Remember, this was before refrigerators and air conditioning, so San Francisco's cooler climate was key to producing chocolate year-round. Since then, throughout the country, most major chocolate companies ramped up production so much, the flavor of their chocolate suffered. They mostly used cheaper bulk beans, added a lot of sugar, making sweet but bland chocolate. Until the 70s, when Bay Area dessert chefs like Alice Medrich reinvented how they approach chocolate.
Can you describe that photo to me?
That photo?
Yeah.
In Alice's North Berkeley kitchen, she has a framed photo of her slumped in a chair, exhausted after the opening day of her famed chocolate shop, Cocola.
The first day? Can I take a photo of that photo?
Yeah. She's feeding me truffles made with three local chocolates.
This guy's dandelion. This is Guittard. I made very little sugar adjustment in these, and I used a lot of chocolate. So
that's why she's known as the first lady of chocolate. For Alice, it all started with a visit to France.
I had a landlady. We lived in her private home, and she made homemade chocolate truffles for us. Compared to the chocolate candy that I grew up with, this chocolate truffle was like a little bittersweet poem.
Alice tinkered with the truffle recipe back in Berkeley.
And people just went nuts for them.
They were packed with real, immensely flavored chocolate.
It wasn't sweet. I mean, of course it was sweet, it was chocolate, but it was very, very bittersweet and it melted like satin on my tongue.
Because she used little sugar and no cocoa powder or shortening, Alice credits her success to the spirit of Berkeley at the time.
I think Berkeley was always more unconventional and accepting and curious.
Which allowed for more innovation. Berkeley customers welcomed Alice's European approach to ingredients, which then spread across the Bay Area and eventually the country. The chocolate truffles we eat now, Alice popularized them first. Back in the 70s, Alice helped change the scene by the way she used the chocolate. She says it paved the way for another chocolate revolution in the 90s, which innovated the chocolate itself.
Yeah. So, yeah, see, it's just endlessly interesting. It's like a whole new world of interesting.
So this is what you meant about, like, just sort of picking things up and experimenting.
Yeah, I mean, the whole new, this sort of what I like to call the second wave of this chocolate revolution, where it's all about the chocolate, is just, it's endlessly complex and interesting. Mm. It's a whole, like, it's like Disneyland of flavor.
What brought on this new wave of chocolate innovation? A company called Scharfenberger. When a doctor named Robert Steinberg got diagnosed with cancer, he left his career and pursued a passion for fine food. He convinced his friend, winemaker John Scharfenberger, to join him.
He showed me a picture of this little chocolate factory he had worked in Lyon called Bernichon. And I looked at that and I said, oh, we can do that.
People now compare artisanal chocolate to fine wine all the time. But back then, Scharfenberger broke ground by focusing on flavor, loading their bars with cacao, chocolate's main and most expensive ingredient.
No one ever talked about cacao, ever.
So, he says, Scharfenberger taught their consumers, even bringing cacao beans to trunk shows.
Everybody was like, what? What's that? People were grabbing them and eating them as if they were almonds. I said, no, their shells are on them, or whatever.
Unlike other American mass chocolate producers, Scharfenberger plastered cacao percentages on their packages. And other chocolate manufacturers had a Willy Wonka approach. No one knew what happened behind closed doors. So when Scharfenberger opened their Berkeley factory to the public, it was a revelation.
The transparency that was common in the wine business, I just transferred it to us.
To chocolate making. But John says the company struggled at first. until one day they assembled a booth at a San Francisco farmer's market. With cacao beans on display, John handed out samples. Within an hour, there were 200 people in line.
Robert and I sat down and said, you know, we just have to do this for the people. Forget the restaurants. That's where it's at.
Scharfenberger sold their bars directly to customers, charging just a bit more than mainstream brands. It worked because fine chocolate was an unsaturated market, and their bars were an affordable luxury. The company grew rapidly until 2005. Then Hershey came along. John insists they weren't looking to sell just yet. But after Hershey doubled their offer for a reported $50 million, John and Robert gave in. 4 years later, Hershey shut down the Scharfenberger factory in Berkeley.
It was really disappointing because it was working. And it, you know, we had so many people coming to it, and it was such a big part of the Bay Area, really. It was a nice thing, and it was disheartening. I mean, I kind of had to put on my my blinders and realize, you know, I had made the decision to sell.
Hershey's acquisition of Scharfenberger left a vacuum within the American artisanal chocolate scene. But soon after, craft chocolate makers popped up everywhere, and even companies that'd been around for generations knew they had to adapt in order to survive. Here's Gary Guittard.
And when John came out with his product, it opened my eyes to a whole different world.
Gary says the new artisanal movement exposed a weak spot he always suspected in Guittard's chocolate making. So he started making chocolate with more distinct flavors.
All the experiments we did, all the things we tried to do to figure out how to do it, really drove me nuts.
Eventually, Guittard expanded their repertoire of cocoa beans, started working directly with farmers, and revamped their production methods. These days, Guittard wants to prioritize flavor over productivity, but it's a tight balance making artisanal chocolate at scale. Guittard just expanded production, but Gary's nostalgic for the company's old San Francisco factory, the kind Dandelion Chocolate has in the Mission today. Dandelion produces two-ingredient small-batch dark chocolate bars, just cocoa beans and sugar. They reflect the Bay's innovative chocolate scene in its most current form. Like Cho, another local craft chocolate, Dandelion's president and CEO, Todd Misonis, has roots in tech.
Couple guys in a garage wanted to make some chocolate, got some machines, just saw if we could do it, and before we knew it, we were making chocolate.
So Todd brings a sort of Silicon Valley maker mentality to chocolate, but he's inspired by more than the startup world.
So I remember when I had my first bite of Scharfenberger, I didn't know that chocolate could taste this way.
Which is why Todd was personally affected by Hershey's acquisition of Scharfenberger. He says Dandelion probably wouldn't exist if not for the sale. Using Scharfenberger as pioneers, Dandelion invites customers behind the scenes through classes and their cafe, even trips to cacao farms abroad. Todd says it's the Bay Area's long history of chocolate that's ushered this current shift.
I think it's the most exciting time for chocolate in the last 150 years. And it's definitely one of the most exciting times to be in the Bay Area since the Gold Rush.
Todd says we'll see even more evolution in chocolate over the next 10 to 15 years, and it's likely to advance right here, because the Bay Area is and always has been ground zero for chocolate innovation. In San Francisco, I'm Asala Sanipour for Cross Currents.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. The history of chocolate making in the Bay Area goes all the way back to the Gold Rush. And over a century later, the Bay chocolate scene is still on fire. The new guard of chocolate makers in town are picking up where a previous generation of innovators left off. They're making great-tasting chocolate, and they're leading a small but potent revolution in the chocolate industry. Reporter Zaina Nasr has more.
In Berkeley, there's a specialty food store called Market Hall. And once a year, they hold a popular event called For the Love of Chocolate.
So again, yeah, it has a completely different flavor profile, right? There's no right or wrong way to taste chocolate.
This year, a small crowd gathers around chocolate expert Vanessa Chang. She stands behind a table covered in chocolate bars and leans forward, guiding her audience through the intricacies of chocolate tasting.
You're going to get flavor profiles. There are dark chocolates out there that taste like molasses and tobacco and leather, like really dark, like whiskey almost. And if you don't like it, it doesn't mean that the chocolate's bad. It's just that not your cup of tea.
Chocolate maker Lan Fan would agree that there's no right or wrong way to taste chocolate.
Maybe you taste one thing, but I taste something different. And that's totally fine because it's subjective as long as we love it, right?
Fan started as a chocolate lover, but then things got serious.
It's almost like a midlife crisis or something. I was working a regular day job, but I wanted to be able to kind of like hold something and know that, okay, this is, I make this. And so I decided that I decided to leave my job.
Fan now spends most of her time making chocolate under the name Ninth and Larkin, which she sells in stores around the Bay Area.
But we are very small. I'm here full-time myself. And then my husband helped me over the weekend or after work sometimes, but that's it.
Do you have any employees?
No, I do not.
Wow. I didn't realize that. So it's just you in this space doing everything.
Yes.
One person doing everything. But she keeps her recipe simple.
In our chocolate, we have cacao beans, cane sugar, and slightly a little bit cocoa butter. That's all.
The complexity of flavor comes from the bean itself, because in each type of chocolate she makes, Fan uses only single-origin cacao beans. This means that each bar is made from beans that come from only one part of the world.
It's almost like you get to travel to that area because how's the temperature in that area or how's the soil or the amount of rainfall and sunlight, it affects how the cacao beans taste. And so it is almost like you can travel with your taste buds when you eat chocolate.
Fan herself is originally from Vietnam, a country that's becoming known for producing high-quality cacao beans.
The connection with Vietnam, that's why I always wanted to kind of carry or make something from Vietnam beans. We do have a few of the origins from Vietnam. And then besides that, we have the Tanzania and Dominican Republic.
Over in Berkeley, Brian Wallace is hard at work on a small batch of chocolate. He also uses single-origin beans from places like Ecuador and Colombia. And his company, Endorphin Chocolate, is a little older and a little bigger than Lan Fan's. Wallace gets started on the batch by sorting through dry cacao beans, roasting them.
And then we crack and winnow them.
To remove the shell from the cacao bean. Then the beans get ground up in a melanger, or large mixing tank. Sugar usually gets added at this stage, and the viscous result gets transferred over to a melting tank, which slowly feeds the chocolate, one squirt at a time, into the tempering machine.
This is our baby. We've named her Phoebe. She fluctuates the temperature of the molten chocolate as it's passed kind of in this cycle. And what she's doing is melting down the crystalline structure that's contained within cocoa butter.
This leads to a shiny and smooth final product, the kind of chocolate that melts in your mouth and makes a satisfying snap when you break off a piece. Brian Wallace works hard for that snap, because the process of making what's called bean-to-bar chocolate is not easy.
How would you define bean-to-bar for someone who has never heard that term before?
You know, the definition of bean-to-bar seems to be a moving target these days, for sure. For us, it's that we buy and source our own cocoa beans and that our chocolate is made using those cocoa beans.
It's a commitment to controlling the chocolate-making process from start to finish, all the way from the bean to the bar. And Wallace is equally committed to celebrating the botany and history of chocolate.
I wanted to put chocolate back in the limelight as this food of the gods and put it back in this place of reverence and respect that it had been in for thousands and thousands of years throughout its history in the Americas.
In San Francisco's Mission District, the bean-to-bar company Dandelion takes the reverence for chocolate to another level. At Dandelion's bustling cafe, they sell single-origin chocolate in the front, make chocolate in the back, and teach chocolate-making classes upstairs.
Excellent! I'm so excited about this class tonight.
The teachers pour cacao beans onto a stainless steel counter and encourage everyone to start sorting them.
All right.
Are we sorting them?
Yeah, let's sort some beans.
All right, so.
Again, I'm happy to continue talking, as you can tell right now. This is what this
is. Continue talking?
Every time Christina and I do a class together, she's like, my only job is to stop Greg from talking.
Is to keep you on schedule.
That's because Greg D'Alessandre is crazy about chocolate. So much so that he's given himself a special title. He's the so-called chocolate sorcerer at Dandelion. In other words, he spends most of his time sourcing cacao beans from farms all over the world. Dandelion's chocolate has only two ingredients in it, cacao beans and sugar.
And when you do just cocoa beans and sugar, the flavor of the beans are really important. And as we started getting deeper into making chocolate, we started to realize, getting good beans is much more about relationships than it is about the beans themselves, almost.
Which is why D'Alessandre says he values the relationships he builds with cacao farmers in places like Belize and Guatemala. He buys beans from them directly, and he pays them well above market rate. Along with other bean-to-bar makers across the country, Dandelion is part of a small but growing shift in the chocolate industry.
The history of cocoa has been one of power dynamics. There's this belief and understanding that cocoa is not worth very much because at one point the cocoa was essentially free because people were growing it in their colonies.
And there's still an undeniable imbalance in the relationship between the countries that grow cacao and the countries that consume chocolate. This is because cacao is strictly grown in the tropics, in developing countries, while chocolate is largely consumed in developed parts of the world, like Europe and the U.S.
If we're ever going to get to a point where there's actual fairness in the whole system, it's not just about changing prices. It's about changing attitudes of what it means to be a cocoa producer versus what it means to be a chocolate maker and how those people interact.
But it's not always easy to figure out how to change these attitudes and what price to pay for cacao beans.
The way I think about it is we don't set the prices. The people who are selling the product to us set the prices. Mm. So we don't even really negotiate.
But how do they know what prices to charge?
That is the question of the decade, maybe even century. I think it is an ongoing process of trying to figure that out.
Which is where Emily Stone comes in. She's one of the founders of Uncommon Cacao, a cacao supplier based in Berkeley that connects small farmers in Haiti and Central America with chocolate makers in the U.S., like Dandelion. And her aim is to change the way that cacao is bought and sold.
Cacao, for the last, really, century, has been traded as a commodity.
And on the commodity market, there's no such thing as a high-quality cacao bean. All beans are treated as equal, and their price is usually set very low. So the only way most cacao farmers can make more money is by selling more beans. And with the push for increased quantity comes inevitable exploitation.
Some of the information that's come out recently over the last 5 or 6 years around the huge problems with child labor, slavery, deforestation, these are all major problems in the chocolate supply chain. And from our perspective, a lot of that is related to price and to the serious undervaluing of cacao as a raw material or as an ingredient.
So when there's a demand for higher quality beans, from bean-to-bar chocolate makers like Dandelion, farmers can begin to ask for higher prices. And along with higher prices, Stone says that ethical trade cannot be achieved without transparency.
We're the only supply chain company in the world in cacao to publish our prices and margins.
It's a new model that Stone calls transparent trade. But she acknowledges that this model still has a long way to go.
I would say that in general, we're still really far from farmers in most of the world earning a living income from cacao.
If progress is to be made, Stone says it comes down to changing the way we think about chocolate and how much we pay for it.
We have been sort of tricked over the last several decades into thinking that chocolate is, cheap.
And bean-to-bar chocolate is not cheap.
At around $8 a pop, it's significantly more expensive than your average supermarket candy bar. So, should we start paying more for chocolate? And what is chocolate actually worth? According to the Bay Area makers leading the bean-to-bar revolution, it's worth a lot more than you think. And the chocolate lovers over at Market Hall in Berkeley seem to agree. In Berkeley, I'm Zaina Nasser for Cross Currents.
Zaina is a graduate of our KALW Audio Academy. She collaborated with former classmate Asal Ehsanipour on this series of chocolate stories. And guess what? Today, we welcomed a new class of Audio Academy fellows. They'll be learning to make stories for radio with us for the next 9 months. Find out more about them at kalw.org. And now for some local music. This is Nervous Lovers from San Francisco. They're performing at Café du Nord this Saturday night. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Ariella Markowitz, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega-Welch, True Quinn, Eli Wirtschafter, and Alice Wolfley. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.